Hi, I'm Celia Fleischaker, Chief Marketing Officer with Verint, the customer engagement company. And today on this book club, I'm joined by Ray Wong of Constellation Research. Welcome, Ray.
Hey, thanks. How you doing?
I'm great. It is good to have you here. Excited to spend the next half hour with you talking about your latest book. But before we get into that, just if anyone on here hasn't met Ray or heard from Ray before, a quick introduction. He is the CEO of Silicon Valley-based Constellation Research. He co-hosts Disrupt TV, which is a weekly show on enterprise tech and business. It has about 50,000 views per episode. He's also written several books. One of them, a bestseller, groundbreaking, was called Disrupting Digital Business back in 2015. And then earlier this year, he came out with Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which is what we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Ray.
Hey, welcome. Really looking forward to it.
I'm excited to talk with you. And, you know, you are this expert on digital business. You do so much around digital. And here I hear that you wrote this book by hand.
A lot of the book was outlined by hand, paper and pencil. Part of it is I'm very visual, right? And I draw things out. And it's sometimes easier for me to actually outline stuff much more quickly. And I think that's part of the fun part. But if I were to do this again, I think I would do speech to text. And I think that's the fastest way to do it, given how good some of these speech to text systems are.
Yep. I know all about those.
You might have something for me, right? You might
have some. I do. I have some great speech and text analytics software I could sell you. So digital giants, which is really a lot of the focus of your book and this, how they've really shifted the business landscape today and how much it changes how a company has to look at how it competes. I thought it was really interesting. And so would you kind of just help the group out and talk about some of the key changes that have happened in the business landscape as a result of these digital giants? What's different today?
Yeah, what's different is we've been talking about digital transformation for some time, and a set of companies we discovered much better than just digital transformation. And we couldn't figure out what that was, but we said, okay, let's go look at the big companies like Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, and say, hey, how are they doing? Right. And when we looked at an indicator like market cap in 2017, it was amazing, yeah. Right? The $2 trillion of market cap in 2017. So we just kept tracking it and we started looking at it. And if you were to go look at the stock market, even today, like right now, the combined market cap of those companies and even, right, let's not even add Tesla to that list, right, is something like $11 trillion. Okay, it's ridiculous. And never before in the history of businesses or enterprises or even capitalism have companies quintupled their market size in 4 years. I mean, it's that market cap is like crazy. And so these companies were doing something really different. And so the question is, were there a next series of companies that were doing similar things? And that's really what gave birth to this concept of digital giants, because we found something like 50 other companies that exhibited the characteristics of digital giants. And we wanted to tie that back into the conversation around digital transformation to say, hey, wait, digital transformation is necessary, but it's not enough. And here are the things that digital giants are doing.
And so that, I mean, they're doing a lot. There's a lot in your book about the importance of cloud, importance of data strategy, AI analytics. And I want to zero in on data, because there are a lot of companies who, despite how far along so many companies are, a lot aren't there yet. They haven't fully transformed. And so this importance of being able to use your data to get rid of those data silos. And you specifically talk about this idea of data supremacy and why it's so critical. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, data supremacy is one of those important areas we talk about. That's one of the elements of success for these digital giants. And what we mean by that is the fact that companies are competing on data. And it's the information and insights, right? You take data, you create, you know, you align that against business processes, whether it's, campaign to lead, whether it's quote to cash, or, you know, whatever process you're in, even hire to retire. And what actually happens is, you start by asking asking the business questions, like, what's going on? What's happening? Do I add 7 more people in marketing, or do I spend $1 million on an ad campaign? How's that going to work? And you don't know the answer to that question, which is why nobody ever asks that question. But the point is, you have to start asking questions like that where you don't know where the data is. And so you start by asking those questions. And then over time, what you start doing is you capture lots of information and insights. You can get high quality data and a small volume, and that's a really good signal. And sometimes you have to get lots of data, bring it in and figure out where the insights and the patterns are. And once you have that, you start figuring out, hey, what are the false positives? What are the false negatives? All right, do we understand, why do you make an exception? Like, why do you break the process here? And that helps these systems get smarter over time. And so we're ultimately getting to a point where you want to talk about what we call decision velocity. Yeah. You and I, we make a decision 1 per second. But what happens is, it takes us how long to get out of management committee? Is it a week? Is it like a quarter? Could it be a year? Well, machines are making hundreds or even thousands of decisions per second. And that asymmetry is creating a competitive disadvantage if you can't make a lot of small decisions very quickly and aggregate those to actually help you make bigger decisions. And that's why that's an important concept. And to get there, you have to have information easily accessible in the cloud. Different types of clouds make sense. Understand where data plays a role, where it's upstream, downstream in the structures. Mm-hmm. And then we actually apply the 3 A's of decision velocity: analytics, automation, and AI. And that's where we're asking the business questions. That's where collecting the data in an automated fashion, right? Self-service, automated streams, and then using that to create this tribal knowledge, which we call the business graph. And that's the foundation for a lot of these companies, this ability to use data and put it into a platform that you can use, which is what we call data-driven digital network.
See, that, I thought that was really cool, this idea. And it's just not about amassing all this data, but it's the quality of the data, how you connect that data. And then I love the idea of using AI to create that decision velocity, which is so cool. And you just mentioned the DDDN concept. Will you talk a little bit more about that too?
Yeah, these data-driven digital networks, or DDDNs, are basically 100-year platforms, and they instrument the data. And what you start learning from things are like patterns, right? What's our demand look like? What happens with our supplies? What actually happens with customer experience? And what happens when you actually tie pricing to this? Or what does customer satisfaction scores look like? And you start collecting this information over time, and you get some interesting patterns. And what it is it's really behind what we call this business graph. The intersection between a customer and an order, or an incident, or a request. What time of day was it? What was the location like? Sometimes we might even know facial expressions. Were they happy? Were they sad? You might be wearing a watch, and I know your heart rate when that occurred. I might know the part of the customer journey you're in, or were you satisfied before you got on the call? And over time, we're mining those insights so that we can deliver better customer experience, anticipate an escalation before it happens, tell that, a customer is unhappy or uncomfortable, right? Sign someone to the right or more appropriate agent, right? All those things are happening. And that's what makes this very exciting.
That's why we're seeing a lot of customers talking about the fact that, it used to be you got the feedback after the fact. Now they're in real time, exactly what you said, taking all these signals, understanding kind of the context for that customer, and being able to deliver, like coach that agent in the moment and improve that. And then I love the idea of getting even further to where it's anticipating the need and proactively servicing or providing a better experience. It's exciting to think about where it goes.
Yeah, it is. And that reactive to proactive pattern gets better over time, right? That becomes the competitive advantage, is that we've had 10,000 incidents, and we can actually understand the patterns of those 10,000. And we know at 2 a.m. when someone, drunk calls a customer service agent, here's what happens, right? Or at 2 a.m. when you get a phone call that sounds like this, it's an urgent issue, and you put your best escalation team on it, right? You get to figure all that out. And people know that already. Like, that's just seasoned agents know that. But can we do that repeatable? Can we do that at scale? Can we actually, be anticipatory about that?
And you said you don't want to be dependent on having seasoned agents. It's amazing that you do, but with the turnover that exists today and the the tough labor market we're in, you want to be able to have those solutions that even if you're not a seasoned agent, you're surrounded by that coaching and that information to be able to appear to be a seasoned agent.
You're right. This coaching thing is super important. And what happens is you've got a lot of seasoned agents and you've got a lot of new members of your team. And to be able to learn from that as well, being able to pull those insights and get folks trained so that they can follow along and see how it works, that's also another added advantage of being able to do this.
So we're talking about how important the data is, especially data about your customers. And one of the things that you talk about that certain companies have done really well is this idea of customer account control disintermediation. And they've been able to kind of wedge themselves in maybe between that original company and their end consumer. Would you talk about that concept and what it does to a company or issues with it?
Yeah, I was speaking yesterday to 100 CFOs, and what was interesting about discussion were a couple things. One is customer account control, and the second thing was about the data of that customer. A great example of this is in the middle of the pandemic, if you were a small business and you had to do delivery, whether you're a restaurant or supplies or things like that, you didn't have the staffing and you didn't have the expertise to do that. So you signed up for a service for delivery, right? And so food delivery apps became really popular. And so what really happened was you took your hundreds or thousands of customers, handed them on a silver platter to whether it's Deliveroo or DoorDash or Uber, and you gave them your best customers. And they took their customer information, they took their credit card information, and now when they go first, they don't think about you, they go to the delivery app, right? So you'd say you're a really well-known restaurant, right? They might call you, but when they're in the mood for food, they go to the delivery app first. And that's the customer account control disintermediation that occurred. Now, it gets even worse from there because they're taking that data, which is your asset, the transactions, and using it to figure out all these things. So food delivery app companies have gotten really smart. They know that Italian is better in this zip code or Thai is better in this other zip code, and they staff accordingly. They know the times and the ranges of, hey, when do they need delivery drivers? They've got demand information. And soon they're using that data to compete against those restaurants by saying, you know what? We can put a ghost kitchen here. If you know what a ghost kitchen is, it's like this big kitchen, which has six or seven different fronts that looks like seven different restaurants. It's really the same one, right? It just looks different on the website. And they go out and they deliver on that, right? And so suddenly what you thought was like a service that helped you turns out to be a way for someone to aggregate all the customers and take it away from you. And you get an interesting situation. And this is where the story of Domino's Pizza comes in, because Domino's, by all means, like when you look at all accounts, is one of the most successful stories of digital transformation. Yeah. You can order a pizza at 5 p.m. on a Friday. Next Friday, the mobile app will remind and say, hey, would you like to make the same order, right? You can track the pizza, it's in the oven, it's 10 minutes away, it's 3 minutes away, it's at your house. And on top of it, you can even do something even more interesting. You can actually order the pizza 11 different ways. And once you get your pizza, you can put it through the AI engine, take a picture of it, send it to the AI engine. It'll tell you the quality of the franchisee. So these guys have won by all means, right? Now, here's the challenge. Food delivery app companies have pretty much eating their lunch, because when you think pizza, you're going to go to them first. You might order pizza once a month, but here you are, right? With these food delivery apps, some people order multiple times a day.
Yeah.
Right. So they're getting the frequency, they're getting the transactions, they're building the data, they're getting the history. And Domino's, for the first time in a long time, had year over year declines in sales. Right. And it's impacting their business. Now, here's the flip side. What if they wanted to, imagine if Domino's opened up their capability to small businesses, created a division called Delivered by Domino's, they could actually open up the order app. They can open up their drivers. They can open all these capabilities and help small businesses be successful and compete against the food delivery app companies. And that's really what's going on here. And so even the most successful company in digital transformation is under assault by a digital giant like an Uber Eats or DoorDash.
Because you can never sit back, right? Like, it's this constant evolution and driving things forward. And that also brings into light one of the kind of success factors or things you talked about was this idea of not going it alone. There's an opportunity for these partnerships and joint ventures, which can really lead to a lot of success. Would you talk a little bit about the importance of partnership?
Partnerships are very important because most companies don't have the DNA of a digital giant. And digital giants are allowed to lose hundreds of millions of dollars a year and nobody cares. And they're growing massively in terms of revenue growth or where they are in terms of their ability to actually attract customers and get to a base around escape velocity. And so if you're not building one, you're better off partnering, and sometimes with your competitors, sometimes across the value exchange, and it gives you that opportunity. So a great example is, let's say we're in the smart building space and you're in commercial real estate. There are three big companies that actually do that. You get, you know, Jones Lang LaSalle. Sometimes you get like, you know, CB Richard Ellis, Cushman Wakefield, use them as examples we do in the book. And, you know, they want to go do smart buildings, right? Great idea. You know, let's, you know, do dynamic pricing per square feet or meter. Yeah. Let's go figure out ad revenues and, you know, digital ads and signage. Let's do mass personalization in retail. We can, you know, do green certification, remote field service, all wonderful things. But to be honest, these companies, it's hard for them to find talent. They don't have necessarily the capital to make it complete. And, you know, it's very hard. They don't also have the technology skills that are there. And so even $150 million is not enough. It's really a $2 billion project. And so for them to get there, it's going to be difficult. So what we suggest is don't go it alone. Create a brand new entity called a joint venture startup, put $150 million down, and then go to your favorite cloud company like Google or Amazon or Microsoft or IBM, like whoever you want to go for your cloud, ask them for another $150 million to create a brand new unit for smart buildings. You get $300 million in place and you're like, great, we're going to get started. But wait, you're not done yet. You got to go choose your favorite, you know, system integrator. You go to them and ask for another $50 million. You build $350 million in place. But wait, we're not done either. We have to partner up, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to go to customers that get it. Honey, ThyssenKrupp, Otis, Johnson Controls. And we go to them and say, for $10 million, we're going to give you 1% of the company, right? And now we raise $450 million for smart buildings. Our market cap on day one is already $2 billion. More importantly, all the talent is going to come over and join us because we're doing some really wonderful stuff. And of course, when we make that announcement, our competitors aren't going to stand still. So let's say I'm Cushman Wakefield, CB Richard Ellis, and Jones Lang LaSalle are like, wait, we can't sit alone and do nothing. So they build their partnership. They put $200 million in. We chose Google. They choose Microsoft. Okay, fine. We choose like, you know, TCS. They choose Accenture or someone. And, you know, by the time they get to the partners, though, Honeywell or Johnson Controls or Schneider Electric, they're like, I'm so sorry. We gave our last $10 million to these other guys. And they'll come back and say, well, you know, what happens if they fail, right? So they'll see a little doubt. They'll get another, some interest. They're like, okay, fine. We can't put our eggs in one basket. We'll give you $1 million. And suddenly we have two players in the marketplace, right? And that's it. I mean, we took what took, you know, companies 40 to 50 years to get to two players in the marketplace to compete. And we can do that in 12 months. But what that means is partners have a shot of actually making this work. And to have two pretty viable competitors to compete, we became duopolies overnight. And that's really what companies are trying to get to, is they want to make sure that the investments are sound, they can actually deliver on it, they've got the tech, the talent, the capital, and there's this competition. But the point being is, you know, they want to also be successful to be able to take this all the way. And so this is
a
new set of models differently.
That compression of timeframes that's available or can happen with the right partner in tech. And one of the things I want to kind of close out talking about is your book has a lot of great frameworks for taking a company through transformation and some of the pitfalls the companies it might face that would derail that transformation. And then also some of what good companies do really well to drive it forward. And one of the pitfalls you talk about is this idea of short-term thinking, which I think plagues a lot of companies today. And it's tough to take that long-term view. And I just wonder, could you talk about some of the characteristics that you see with those longer-term thinking companies, what they look like and the benefits that it brings if they can get out of that short-term trap?
Yeah, we talk about the life cycle of organizations. And that's the framework you're referring to. And it really goes back to understanding how your company got started. I mean, you start out, you build a company, you've got a great idea, mission or purpose, a dynamic founder comes in, grabs everyone they can, they tap into their talent networks, bring some great people together, becomes a wonderful place to work. They go out and then we build an awesome offering, whether it's a product or service, right? People get excited about it, use awesome design to get there. And then you take it to market, right? You go regional, right? Or you choose an industry and go deep, or you choose a sector, or you take a, you know, say, we're going to go tackle this geography. And all that's great. That building process makes a company strong. It builds the brand. It gets people excited. And then you go public, right? And after that moment, nothing is ever the same again, right? Because you're dictated by quarterly earnings and projections. And so you start to skimp on product development to get, you know, to make your margins, or you don't hire the best people anymore because, like, oh, we can train them here. Or you forget to, you know, like take care of, like, you know, a product feature that should have been done because you just keep punting down the line. And pretty soon, like, you know, 40 years in or 30 years in, you have no idea what the company does. Like, people are there, but they're not really sure what the company is about. And so you need that transformation. And that's what we're talking about. Sometimes you do it through PE, right? You buy yourself 3 to 5 years so you can reorganize, restructure, get focused. And there's good PE and there's bad PE. Sometimes you change it around by getting better capitalization. So you bring in better talent. Right. Sometimes what happens is a new technology pops in, like cloud or AI or your ability to actually change your offering. Other times you start realizing that we're not selling products anymore, or services or experiences or outcome. The data and the insights become more powerful. And then, of course, you have to re-educate your long-term investors and your board, because they've got to also think in the long-term frame for you to be able to get there. You need those five elements. They all have to happen at the same time. That's why people fail. People typically do three of them and say, oh yeah, this is going to be successful. But what we've discovered is all five have to be in place.
But the benefits of all five, one of the studies you cite about thinking long-term and operating that way, the companies that do it, their revenue, these are what, 47% higher, they're 40% higher. It's pretty amazing the results if someone can get there to start thinking that way and drive a company that way.
It is. And it requires a different set of investors, a different type of leader, a different type of mindset, but it's not impossible. Companies have definitely done that.
Last question, just to close it out. Customer loyalty, driving it in a digital world. There's so many changes around here. We've talked about the data and how different it is. How do you think about that? What's important to think about?
Yeah, the challenge is people are trading loyalty for value, right? I got a better price. People are trading loyalty for convenience. It was easier to work with. People are trading loyalty for availability, right? Like, when your brand's not available on the store shelf because of a supply chain crisis, right? You are just picking a substitute. People are trading loyalty for mission and purpose. Like, we don't like your company, right? We're going to do something else. Or we love your company and that's why we're loyal. And you've seen that with brands across the board. And then people are just trading loyalty because they can, right? I mean, and so customers aren't loyal like they used to be. And so this really means that we have to look at this very differently and understand those factors and those attributes as to what creates a purchase decision, what gets people to buy, or what gets people to renew. And this gets more important because as we move to subscription revenue models and memberships and digital goods and services, the ability to switch becomes very, I mean, it's easy. And so there's a lot of focus on where customer experience plays a role in terms of transforming that that overall process. That's where customer experience plays a role in terms of loyalty or improving, you know, order size. And so there's a doubling down on brands that really care about customer experience and how they reflect their brand in that process.
Awesome. Well, we're at time, and I just want to say thank you so much, Ray, for joining us today. I encourage everyone to read the book. There's a link in the chat. If you're one of the first 25 to fill that form, we'll send you the book. And then, of course, it's available online and in stores as well. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me here. Really appreciate it and really enjoy being on the book club.
Great to see you. Bye.